Welcome to season 4 of our podcast, Nature Bounce, brought to you by Go Jauntly, a walking, wayfinding, and nature connection app available for free on the App Store and the Play Store. Nature Bounce is hosted by me, Hannah Such, co-founder and CEO at Go Jauntly. This podcast is an opportunity for us to banter and share learnings and insights with you and a series of truly inspirational people we've met on our journey. We'll talk green living, nature, walking, well-being, and more. If you like what you hear, please do rate and subscribe to the whole series. Go Jauntly is an everyday walking app designed to inspire you to walk more and get out and about in enjoying nature. Whether you stomp, roam, ramble, hike, or wander, we have unlimited walking trails for you to enjoy. You can download our free walking app and enjoy your very own pocket-sized encyclopedia of urban walks. Search Go Jauntly on your app store. On today's episode, we'll be chatting to Zoe Palmer. Zoe is an artist, writer, and human ecologist working at the intersection of the arts, health, and ecology. Her work is incredible and spans live performance, installation, and curated participatory events. Her regenerative practice explores our relationship with the more than human world, centering on underrepresented narratives and knowledge through a decolonial lens. Zoe, welcome to the show. I'm so pleased to have you here today.
Thanks, Hannah. It's lovely to be here.
I'm just reflecting on the last time, or in fact, the first time I met you at the Nature Inquiry, where we did this amazing workshop that I don't even know if I can describe it to people, but we kind of submerged ourselves in nature and drank tea and like made like this pocket kind of calming thing. It was just brilliant. Do you do those kind of things quite often?
I do, yeah. It's kind of broad part of my practice, I guess, that kind of very immersive embodied approach to working with nature.
Yeah, I've never done anything like that at all, really. Just kind of plucked something from a tree and then like tasted it and like felt the senses change as time went on. It was just brilliant. But I'd love for you to share a little bit more about your work, because I know you do incredible things.
I guess in my work, I'm just really curious to explore the intersections between arts, health, and ecology, and how they collide and what happens at this intersection. And asking questions like, whose narratives do we center? Whose knowledge systems do we hold up? And how can we disrupt and dismantle those systems using joy as our fuel? I guess I'm asking, how can we sing and dance and sort of nourish our activism from a place that feels regenerative and restorative and reciprocal? And what might that look like? So I guess practically, in terms of projects that I do, last year with Jennifer Farmer, I co-created the Dreaming Field Lab, which was a rest retreat for women and femmes, Black women and femmes. In the British rural landscape. And we explored notions of collective care and ancestral ecologies, and all of these in the context of climate breakdown, what that looks like, and rest and ritual and things. Some of my work as a writer recently includes Breathing Forest, which was a piece of new music by composer Sam Fernando about, I guess it was a kind of meditation on the act of forest bathing. And that was recently on Radio 3, and I collaborate with a group at Carnegie Hall who have just done a show with called Camille's Rainbow, which was all about colour and emotion and emotional worlds. And then more recently, just like last week, I've delivered some walks for Teatro Fahodzi as part of Black Earth, which is their project centering resistance, racism and the environment. And we've been developing care packages and exploring creative resistance and some of the obstacles racialized communities face in terms of connecting with the climate crisis and connecting with nature. I guess it's really about just meeting and developing a relationship with nature on our own terms and sort of unleashing our radical imaginations in that space.
I just love hearing you talk. It all sounds incredible. I've got like a million questions now. And so we might go off piste a little bit. But like, what's in the care package? I love the sound of that.
I don't even know if I'm allowed to tell you yet.
Oh, okay.
I can tell you, maybe I can tell you one, there's one thing that you're familiar with. I can give you that hint.
Yes,
there's one thing you're familiar with that you've made. So there will be some dreaming pillows. So again, we're centering this idea of dreaming as a radical response to sort of capitalism and the colonial mindset, and just encouraging people to take time to rest and dream and connect with plants and herbs in that way, and really support our systems when we're doing kind of activist work, which can be quite depleting.
Yeah, I think that's really on point, isn't it, right now? Because we were just talking before the call started about how tired, or how things feel like a lot harder nowadays, and we're like bombarded with news, and often bad news, and things don't seem to be getting better. But actually, napping is like almost like a form of protest, a bit like walking.
definitely a bit like walking, and so simple. It's like the simplest thing, walking, you know. It's wonderful.
Yeah, there's a book, isn't there, coming out about how napping is like a kind of the antidote to sort of capitalism in a way, and helps you nourish yourself and feel more restorative. I mean, I'm a regular nap taker and I'm very lucky in that I can nap during the day and still sleep at night, which I know some people have problems with. Does the dreaming pillow sort of help kind of put you in a place where you can have more lucid dreams, or is it just that it helps make you feel more restful?
I guess it's a combination of both. So some of the herbs that are in the pillow are herbs that historically have been associated with the actual quality of dreams. So in the British pharmacopoeia, things like mugwort has been used for centuries as a kind of dreaming herb. It's believed to enhance the quality of dreams. It's also used in some Native American traditions for similar kind of purposes. And then you've got things like hops, which are sort of sedatives and calming. They calm the nervous system. So yeah, it's like a combination of different things, rose, lemon verbena, lots of different scents that will all help kind of calm our systems before we go to sleep. But we can also use them in the daytime as well, and use them kind of for daydreaming, I guess.
Yeah, that sounds great. And do you think that some of this knowledge around sort of plants has been lost, or is it just that we have a disconnect with nature nowadays, and therefore people just don't know that these things are elements that you can find out on a walk or potentially in a nature reserve? Yeah. and highlighting them.
Yeah, I think it's exactly that. I think there's a real fear these days around there's a whole thing about what's woo-woo and what's this and what's that and what's credible and what's not credible. And so I'm really interested in saying all different knowledge systems are credible. We can hold them all. They don't have to be in competition with each other. So we can have Western medicine, and we need to work alongside herbal medicine and have the knowledge of the plants. And bearing in mind that a lot of our drugs that we use these days in Western medicine have actually been synthesized from drugs that were developed by Indigenous communities in the first place. So it's kind of ironic that they're always held in this very binary kind of opposing way. So I guess it's just about really giving people the confidence to go out and to know which herbs they can work with to support their bodies at this time, and support their minds and their emotional well-being, and just to encourage people to connect with the plants and say, you know, these are our allies at this time and they're here for us. And if we take them from a place of gratitude and from a sense of reciprocity, they can be really, really supportive to our bodies and minds at this time.
Yeah, I'm really feeling this, because I really wasn't connected to nature when I was a kid, and this happened for me sort of like really late on in life. Like, I used to feel, this is only a few years ago, like a little bit weird following a bee around and things like that. And to be honest with you, like the first time, this is a bit embarrassing, but the first time I'd smelt hops properly was with you. And I've always looked at them and thought, oh, they're so pretty, and like things like that, and like, oh, it's funny that they're turned into a bear. But I had never thought to sort of like maybe like pick them when they were dry and like crunch them together and smell them. And I think your point about fear is quite strong, because, you know, like when I was a kid, they were like, don't touch the berries, don't touch the mushrooms, they could be poisonous and things like that. So it was really strange. But then sort of later on nowadays, I'm seeing a lot of sort of Chinese medicine and Chinese teas and things like that being sold in like new packets that you can now get in Planet Organic. And when I was a kid, I was like, oh, I'm not going to have that, even though I'm, you know, half Chinese myself. My mum used to drink it all the time. It's just strange, isn't it? Like culture and society and the systems and the issues around, you know, colonialism and things like that, that have caused this kind of almost probably helped create a disconnect from nature in a way.
I totally feel that, like what you've articulated, like I feel like there's been a manufactured disconnect and a sense of manufactured lack, you know, so that consumerism and capitalism are driving a sense of lack within us. So we have to look externally, whereas actually if we look internally and we connect with nature and we are a part of nature, and if we have that kind of sense of internal knowledge and internal abundance, and the natural world is a part of us, you know, we wouldn't have so much that fear of being in that place that is a part of us. And we wouldn't have to look really, really externally to fulfill our kind of needs and our longings and our desires, and just sort of come to a place of, I guess, contentment, really. And I think that sense of capitalism really manufacturing lack. That's what we're kind of recovering from, and that sense of, and then that tying into a sense of having to be very productive, and then the burning out and the exhaustion. It's all kind of within that colonial capitalist mindset that we're kind of pushing back against now and really challenging and trying to disrupt with these conversations.
Yeah, no, it's brilliant. I'm getting goose pimples just thinking about it, because I think for me, like my journey to nature connectedness, I feel like one with nature, but also separated from nature because of time and capitalism and work and things like that. And I feel like maybe I'm not used to using all of my senses. Like I can do feel, think, see, but it's like that, maybe that taste, I haven't, taste and smell is something that I'm still working on. I know it sounds silly though, because like, berries are like my favorite things, and literally these are things that are like the fruit of nature, like so much is the fruit of nature, but I just haven't connected it. But I guess it's a journey, right? And we're all like this, like we some of us have really good connection with nature, but you know, many people, myself, like living in cities, maybe haven't had direct access to green space and things like that. It's a longer journey, and that's okay, because at least you're on the journey, right?
Yeah, exactly. It's totally okay. And there were definitely times in my own journey when I was living in London, for example, in my early 20s, when I felt extremely disconnected from nature and got really depressed, and then, you know, and had to find ways out of that and ways to reconnect. But I hadn't left London for like 5 or 6 years in my early 20s. And it led to a really sort of negative state of mind. And part of that's why I'm here now and why I'm doing what I'm doing, because I really recognize that. And so we're all on our own path to this, and it's not about sort of measuring where we're at, but just about that constant sense of curiosity and I guess opening up to being in connection. I guess that's the difficulty. I think the first step of opening up to that sense of creating connection.
Yeah, that makes sense. So can you share a little bit more about, you know, what shaped your connection with the natural world? You kind of just touched on it then. Did you have a really good relationship with nature when you were younger, like before your 20s?
Yeah, I did. I guess I grew up in Hackney, and we had a tiny little garden, but it was teeming with frogs and birds. And but on Sundays, we'd always go for a walk, and we'd always walk out to places like Epping Forest, Hackney Marshes. That's where I saw my first kingfisher when I was like 6 years old. We'd always be walking out in nature, but within London. And in the holidays, I was lucky because some of my family lived in Dorset and Devon. So then we'd go like to sort of the Purbeck coastline and spend time there. So I got to know the kind of countryside as well. And I also had an amazing teacher at primary school who was like, I can't believe this thinking back on it, but she was an ecologist. We had an in-house ecologist primary school in Dalston in like the 80s. Yeah,
that's brilliant.
And I just loved her, and she really fired my imagination. So I did have a strong, like, she took us to Camley Street Nature Reserve in King's Cross. You know, it was all about urban nature. So people think that's kind of a new thing, but it's been going on for a long time. It was just much, much more under the radar. And then as a teenager, I did a lot of walking, like all that Duke of Edinburgh stuff. I walked around the Peak District.
Did you do that? Oh, wow.
Yeah, I did all of that stuff. So really it was like, I really walked my way around. I walked my way into connection with nature. And then, as I mentioned, I got kind of stuck in London for a bit in my early 20s, but that kind of inertia and really a sense of depression, really that lack of connection pushed me up and into doing a master's in human ecology up in Scotland. And that sort of took me on the next stage of my journey. I guess the trouble there with doing that then was that I became very alive to the whiteness of the environmental movement.
Yeah.
And that there was very little talk back then, this is 15 years ago, of intersectionality and diversity and environmental justice. And I did feel like a kind of lone voice in the room, you know. So that was a whole different challenge. But, you know, that was sort of my
background. Some improvement, slowly but surely. There's a lot more diverse voices, isn't there, which is good. But there's still sort of so much work to do. It's never ending in a way, is it? But I read some research around how, like, there's quite often a teenage dip in nature connectedness. And I wonder if that's what happened to you. I know you said your 20s, but maybe you'd got other priorities, you know, you were like growing up in London, like finding yourself, and then you do slip out of things like going for regular walks with the family on a Sunday and stuff that. And so you can see like that arc almost happening. But it's great that you relatively quickly realized what was missing in your life, and you were able to kind of redirect it into a direction that was going to be, you know, much more joyful and regenerative. So that's great. How do you cope now? I mean, this is a hard question probably, but how do you cope now balancing, I don't know, things like coming up with a very white space, but also potentially like the kind of horrors of climate breakdown and the lack of climate justice? Like, how do you manage to like balance and keep your eco anxiety at bay?
That's a really good question. I guess I've to be honest, I've struggled with anxiety and PTSD since my early 20s, and nature has really been my medicine through that, and that walking and all those things I've talked about has been my medicine. Eco-anxiety is something I've had to work on this a lot, but it's something I've tried really hard not to take on. So it's like, I'm really acknowledging the grief and the sense of overwhelm that I feel and the emotions I feel in response to climate breakdown. But I guess my choice that I've made has been to channel that and to ask questions and to say, where can I find, or where can we as a community incubate hope? And how can I use my sense, this strong feeling that I have, in service of liberation for sort of the community that I work within, particularly communities of colour who are disproportionately affected by the effects of climate breakdown. So I guess, I've just been trying to flip it and just trying to channel that feeling and say, how can we cultivate joy? You know, where is the space for joy within this? You know?
Yeah.
There's a really wonderful quote from Alice Walker that I love, which is like, hard times require furious dancing.
I love that. That is so on point. Yeah.
I love it so much. And it just makes me feel that's where we're at right now. And it's not to invalidate those difficult feelings, but it's just to say, can we dare to imagine that this is not the time to sink into despair and apathy? And perhaps it's time to dance with all our might and bring all of that to bear in this moment of deep flux and transformation. You know, it's like Adrienne Marie Brown says, we need to rehearse our freedoms, we need to dream and vision possibilities for our lives and unleash our radical imaginations, and then embody these for the biosphere, like on behalf of the biosphere, so that they can come alive. And I guess my sense is that the arts, I feel like the arts and, you know, combining the arts with nature connection, that has a really important role to play in this, in where we're at right now.
Yeah, I think that's a really nice way of trying to cope with it in increasingly challenging times. I think I'm a little bit guilty of getting saddened. Like, I just feel so sad. I'm like quite a sensitive person. And so I see things like 33 million people being displaced in Pakistan, and I'm just like, I find it really hard to reconcile in my brain. So the only way that I can cope really is on one level continuing the work at Go Jauntly and trying to help people on the journey to nature connectedness, but I never feel like it's enough. And so like climate activism is a thing, but I'm just not, I don't think I'm, like, I really admire everything that Just Stop Oil have done, like, and the way they've kind of challenged perceptions, but I just don't know if I'm ready to go and like climb up Dartford Crossing.
Yeah, I know exactly how you feel. I feel like that. I feel exactly the same. I feel like I'm not doing enough on a daily basis. Like,
and we are, which is crazy.
Like, but that's the thing. That's the thing. It's, I think it's the burden of awareness. You know, it's, that's the difficulty in these times. You know, it's almost like there can never be enough right now. So, like, what is our response? You know, and how can we just channel down into what we are doing?
And just try and
really hold on to that feeling that actually we don't know how, you don't know how to Go Jauntly is impacting people's lives. You know, you don't know all the nuances of the impact that you're making, which I'm sure are really, really huge, you know. So I guess it's that.
Yeah, it's thinking about that a bit more. I'm writing notes as you talk, and I've written hope in capital letters, and I've just been drawing a circle around it.
Hi everyone, it's Shane here. As many of you know, Go Jauntly is a free app, but there's a great way to support our small team by upgrading to a premium subscription, and it costs less than a cup of coffee per month. With the premium subscription, you get access to hundreds of specially curated walks and tours, and you can download routes to use in offline mode, which saves on mobile data. Plus, you're supporting our team and our mission to get more people walking. Upgrade to premium in the app now for just $1.99 a month. Today, I wanted to highlight our new Elizabeth Line jaunts, a series of lovely routes near the various stations of the Elizabeth Line. From a countryside stroll in Twyford to a hidden green space wander near Tottenham Court Road, there's a route for everyone in this collection. Check them out in the app now.
Your Twitter feed, it's full of like nuggets of hope and stuff, which I just really, really appreciate, because there's not much around at the moment. But so, like, have you got any tips or advice for people who potentially are on a similar journey to you and want to bring art and nature connection into the kind of masses? Like, have you got any tips on how to do that?
I guess, like, some really sort of practical ways in which I mean, I guess it's around focusing on my own sense of nature connection, so that can then ripple out, and really making sure that I've got my own house in order before I go out and talk to other people about it. Yeah. So I guess it's around that. It's about extending your own practice and allowing yourself to take the time to develop your own practice and your own connections. So, for example, a really simple way that I do that in the beginning of the day is by making a brew of tea. Like, we did the tea tasting when we were at the Nature Inquiry, and I don't do it in such a ritualized way on a daily basis, but I do go out, do pick a herb, and I recognize that I'm lucky enough to be able to grow my own herbs, but I used to grow them on my balcony in Hackney as well. You know, you don't need a big space, but just that thing of picking a herb, picking a plant, and making your own tea and connecting with a plant, it takes like 5 or 10 minutes at the start of the day, you know, or going barefoot out into nature, or walking around the block, like, you know, taking a short walk, encouraging yourself, giving yourself permission to just really observe the natural world around you while you do that. And just those really simple practices, I think, can over time become, they're kind of cumulative, you know, and over time they can really enhance your sense of, well, not only well-being, but your sense of connectedness with the natural world.
Yeah, that makes sense. And I think it is really important to, like, look after yourself, because I think a lot of climate activists and sort of people working in this field, they're like, we spoke about earlier, oh, we're not doing enough, but actually, you know, you can only do as much as you can do as long as you feel good. Like, as soon as you feel sad, tired, worried, like, it's really healthy to just take yourself away from it, switch off Twitter. Like, yesterday I wasn't feeling the vibes, so I did the whole nap thing. I just was like, right, I'm fed up with today. I got into my bed, put the duvet over me, and I was just like, yeah, just was like, yeah, I'm not going to do any work.
Good for you. Daytime naps is so good.
Yeah, I highly recommend. I'd love to learn more about the project that you're doing in Bristol with the theatre company that you talked about. Are you allowed to share any more about that yet, or is it
I can. It's Teatr Fachodzi, who are the kind of UK's British African Heritage Theatre Company, and so they've set up this project, Black Earth: Resistance, Racism and the Environment. So it's really a kind of research project and really challenging, like, and questioning how the theatre industry can engage with these issues rather than, you know, as opposed to just telling people to kind of use less paper in their offices. Much more kind of in-depth. And the producer, Marcus Bernard, really wanted to have a much more in-depth conversation around these issues. So we've been offering nature walks. They've been offering some artist commissions and workshops around coming to a kind of working definition of climate justice in our communities. And we're also developing care packages. But in terms of the walks, so we've done a walk in Watford in Cassiobury Park, which is a really beautiful park, huge, about 5 minutes walk from Watford station. So really accessible to people. It's an SSSI, it's got a gorgeous kind of nature reserve and different landscapes. There's a sort of very sculpted park section, then you go into a kind of wetland area, then off into the woods and the forest. So we've done some walks around there, which were sort of centered around our kind of decolonial connection with nature and connecting with herbs that are there and just how we experience that landscape. And then we've done another set of walks in Lee Woods in Bristol. So literally in sight of the Clifton Suspension Bridge, there's this beautiful, beautiful, beautiful woodlands. It's a site itself that's been extracted over the years for sandstone and other minerals. So nature itself there has been plundered and extracted from. So it felt like a really good place. It felt like the conversation really resonated around like colonialism and reciprocity and extraction and like how nature itself has been bound up and has become agents of capitalist projects like slavery and things like that. We had those conversations there. So yeah, we kind of were tuning it to the landscape that we were walking in. We were kind of honing the conversation to the landscape, so it was really a kind of embodied practice. So
and so did you manage to sort of frame climate justice in a way that you were happy with at the end of these sort of sessions? Was it like a group discussion, and who were the types of people coming to these walks? Can anyone join?
Yeah, anyone can come along, and we really welcome allies as well. Although it's been sort of, I guess it's been marketed to people of colour to try and encourage people of colour to come along. But we're really welcoming to allies, and we think that conversation is really important too, actually. And that's the way the conversation will actually ripple out into community.
It sounds like it. I really hope we can get those walks on the app and all of the insight and knowledge there so that we can help spread the word, because it just sounds like something that's deeply missing from the conversation around climate breakdown. And I think one of the issues is that it's not happening, like the effects of climate breakdown have been happening for a long, long time for people in the global south. And, you know, it's just starting to touch on people in the global north. And I think we need more empathy, like an understanding around it, because it feels like it's missing. Like, I don't want to labor on it because it is, you know, we talked about hope, but it is important. It's so important, and it needs to be a conversation that, you know, people are having all the time, not just as something happening over there. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I think it's so challenging on so many levels, this conversation, and there's all kinds of things that get brought to bear in it. You know, there's a sense of our privilege, because at the moment we're relatively safe from the effects, relatively, I say in inverted commas, you know, safe from the effects of climate change. But, you know, there are communities up north we've had terrible flooding, as we know. There are communities who have been affected by landslides and coastal erosion, you know, in the UK. Communities have had to be relocated, so it is happening on our shores as well. But there's still, like you say, a real disconnect, and there seems to be a real inability for people to empathize really with the scale of that. And I guess that's the culture of denial that has also been manufactured by the industry, by the climate denial industry. And that was, I actually wrote my thesis on climate denial like 15 years ago. So it was all about how the lobby then were putting so much money into manufacturing false narratives, which we all know about now. But that was an industry that is a very, very powerful lobby. The fossil fuel lobby is very powerful. And so that has been manufactured in us, you know. And so the challenge is for us to actually see, again, like in this time, this age of post-truth, is for actually like, what is the truth, and how can we empathize and connect with the truth of the situation right now in a way that doesn't overwhelm us, like so we're completely ineffective.
It's such a hard balance because like I get a little bit frustrated, like living in the city. I'm in Southeast London in Brockley, which I do love. It's surrounded by green space and everyone's really nice, and people recycle and they take care of, like, they try and take care of their local space and things like that. But it's still, it feels to me like there's still like not enough happening, and the conversations are so hard to have with people without, I don't know, like bringing the vibe down.
I know, it's very difficult to be the person in the room who mentions it. It's difficult.
I've had friends, like really lovely friends, just like look at me like I'm like the woman walking around with a placard saying the end is nigh. It's things like this that you were talking about, like art and nature connection workshops, getting people out walking like we're trying to do, and appreciating the rest of the natural world and understanding that we are nature too. You mentioned it at the start, and I think that is just something. But also that messaging is actually quite nice, isn't it? That kind of like, we are nature too. It's not necessarily alienating, or it's not frightening. So focusing on that and kind of leaning into that and spreading that message feels like hopeful.
And I think you've touched on something there again around fear and around the framing of the narrative, because the narrative around climate change, you know, there's so much fear, and there's so much fear of the power of nature and the destructive force of nature. And it's all, we've almost been set on this binary, like, you know we now have to fight and defend ourselves against the forces, the unruly force of nature. And so actually just turning that round and saying, well, actually, let's think about this in another way. You know, let's remember that this is a manifestation of hundreds of years of the way we've been behaving and destroying the planet. And actually, yeah, it's a facet of ourselves, right? It is a facet of ourselves on some level.
Yeah, that's so true. Are you going to write a book, or have you already written a book and I'm really ignorant? Because I feel like you need to.
That's weird, you're the second person that's told me that. Maybe I need to.
I can see one book around. We've got a whole library of books here. I can see one book around like kind of herbs and like helping you kind of not necessarily forage but appreciate touch, smell. There's one book, and then there's a whole other book on like restoration and regenerative, maybe like a workbook or something.
Maybe it's a great idea. I do need to get back. You know, I've been raising a little girl for the last 5 years. She's just started school, so you know what phases are like when you're a mother. There's certainly phases, I think, in terms of like how much you can focus on large projects like that. And so but something like that would be good one day.
Not to try and like, you know, get you to do loads more work, because you're already doing the work. Like, you go out walking a lot. Where's your favorite place to go for a walk? Do you have one?
I love this question. When you've got a young child, like any walk longer than 20 minutes is a good
vibes.
Walk. But I was thinking back. Yeah, I was thinking back to like my utmost favorite place is in the UK is the Pembrokeshire Coastal Path.
Oh, and that's so nice.
I just love it so much. And there's a section between Cardigan Bay and a town called Newport, small Newport, not the big Newport, little Newport. It's a little fishing town village. And that section there is just absolutely stunning. And I've done it. I've been back there again and again and again. And on one walk I did that, I spent a day walking that section, and there were dolphins swimming parallel, like pretty much most of the day. It was incredible. It's so tranquil, and yeah, it's got a very special place in my heart. I love it there. But I mean, just thinking about London and where I used to escape to in London to walk when I really wanted to get to a different landscape. There's a place called Elmley on the Isle of Sheppey. Have you heard of it?
Yes, I have. I've always wanted to go. That's the nature reserve, isn't it?
It's so gorgeous. And like, you even have to take, like, it's only an hour or an hour and a half out of London to Sheppey, and you have to take like the train goes onto a single track. You have to press a bell to stop it. It's like a real adventure, you know, and it's so easy to get to from London. And it, to me, it feels like being out on the savannah. The landscape is so different. I'm a bit of a bird geek, and there are loads of great waders and good birds there. So yeah, that's my second favorite place. If I'm going from London, that was my little retreat space I used to always go to. Really beautiful.
I've seen it, and for the last 5 years, I'm like, really need to go to Elmley. And now you've said it, and I found like there's this like, I think it's called Canopy and Stars website, yes, where you can do like a sort of like glamping / treehouse type thing. They've got like this beach hut right there, and it's got my name on it, I think.
Definitely.
That's such a good tip. Where does the train go from?
You have to get the train to Sittingbourne, right? You get the train from London to Sittingbourne, then you change at Sittingbourne and get this little single track train which goes across the bridge to Sheerness. And I actually can't remember the name of the stop, but there's a stop on that way. You have to ring the bell and get off at Elmley, and you walk for like 5 minutes and you get to Elmley, or 10 minutes you get to Elmley. And yeah, it's just gorgeous.
That sounds fantastic, and real ability to sort of escape the city without having to travel too far. What a great tip. Yeah, thank you. And what do you bring on a walk with you? What's your go-to?
Always good snacks. So yeah. Dry roasted peanuts.
They're a classic.
Chocolate, like literally snacks, treats, things like that. And quite often a thermos flask. I'm a bit of a geek, so I like
having a thermos. Is that with hot water, and then you like make your own tea whilst you're there? Or
I normally make the tea before I leave. Okay. So I can just sit down and feel very snug and warm, especially on a cold day. It's a really nice treat when you sit down somewhere and you're all damp and, you know, but I love having a thermos.
Yeah, that's such a good tip. Thank you so much. It's been so beautiful to speak to you. I feel so lucky. Thank you so much for coming on Nature Bounce. I can't wait for everyone to hear this episode.
Oh, likewise, Hannah. Thank you for having me.
Thanks. You can use the Go Jauntly app to find curated walks based on your location. Simple photo guides help you navigate, while nifty tips point out things of interest, hidden gems, and places to eat. Walking challenges have been designed to help motivate you to walk more, from distance challenges to daily steps challenges. The choice is yours. You can download the app for free on the App Store or the Play Store. Thanks so much for listening to this episode of Nature Bounce. Don't forget to rate it and subscribe to the whole series. If you like what you've heard today, please do share this episode with your family and friends. Nature Bounce was brought to you by Go Jauntly, a free, multi-award-winning walking, wayfinding, and nature connection app. To find out more, please visit gojauntly.com and discover a world of outdoor adventure on your doorstep and beyond.